I'm Jen De La Vega.
And I'm Clara Park.
And welcome to The Cinema Chefs, the podcast for people who love to cook, watch movies, and cook what they see in the movies. Today, we are going to talk about diner food in Pulp Fiction. Some spoilers ahead if you haven't seen the movie, and if you're going to watch it, I want to issue a very strong content warning for extreme violence, sexual violence, profanity, drug use, and many, many racial slurs. So if that stuff is really triggering for you, do not watch
it. Don't watch the movie.
No, for real, I'm being serious. Yeah, it is triggering for me. I was like, wow. They say that so many times.
This movie has not aged well at all.
Not at all.
What is the one sentence summary of the movie? The lives of two hitmen, a boxer, a gangster and his wife, and two amateur robbers converge in the seedy underbelly of LA. And a $5 shake, not adjusted for inflation.
Nice. We chose this movie because it was a monster hit when it first came out, and so many of the key scenes involve food and dining out. More specifically, the film highlights cheap eats like diner food, fast food, and highly processed supermarket staples like cereal and Pop-Tarts, or toaster pastries, as they are Greeked in the movie. But just because something is cheap and lowbrow doesn't mean it can't be delicious.
Pulp Fiction came out in 1994. Written and directed by Quentin Tarantino and starred Samuel L. Jackson, John Travolta, and Uma Thurman. The stellar cast also had Bruce Willis, Ving Rhames, Rosanna Arquette, Steve Buscemi, Christopher Walken, and Tim Roth. It was nominated for numerous Oscars, including Best Picture, Best Director, Best Acting Nod to Jackson, Travolta, and Thurman, and Editing. Ultimately, it only won Best Original Screenplay for Tarantino. This movie also famously revived Travolta's acting career, who hadn't really done anything since Look Who's Talking.
Wait, wasn't Bruce Willis also in that one?
Yes! The voice of Baby Mikey!
I think this is our first big ensemble cast that we've covered here on The Cinema Chefs. And I also want to point out Amanda Plummer, who is Wire-S in the Hunger Games movies.
I totally forgot about that. I feel like such a long time passed between this movie and The Hunger Games. So
it didn't
even occur to me that she was the same person.
I don't think I realized how pervasive food and conversations about food were in this movie. I mean, everybody remembers that whole bit about what Europe calls a McDonald's quarter pounder. Say it with me. Royale with cheese.
Because we don't have the metric system in America.
Exactly. Why do we have to make everything so difficult with our arbitrary imperial measurements?
Agree. 100%. The simplicity and elegance of doing everything with base 10 is the best way to go. Whenever I'm teaching young cooks about measurements, it's always so confusing to them. Why is it 3 teaspoons to a tablespoon, but 16 ounces to a pound, and 4 quarts to a gallon? There is no method to the madness.
Yeah, it's certainly easier in metric when scaling recipes. I have to use both cups and grams because I convert them often between international publications. So yeah, it definitely is more accurate and efficient to do metric.
Especially for dry ingredients. A standard cup of flour weighs 120 grams. But if people pack the flour, it can be almost 200 grams, which will definitely mess up your cake recipe.
Or any recipe for that matter. I mean, that's why you gotta pay attention to whether it says packed or loose in the recipe. 1 pound is 454 grams. Just to further illustrate the nonsense of imperial measurements, I think for people who are getting serious about cooking and baking, it's imperative to get a kitchen scale for accurate measurements.
Definitely. I have both a digital and a spring scale. What about you, Jen?
I do have both. Yeah, I have a digital and a very old school Cuisinart spring scale. It's very like 90s and white and kind of designy, like one that's not meant to be used, certainly from my mother's kitchen.
Yeah, I have one like that too. The spring scale is round and plastic and it's really grossly inaccurate, so I don't really use it.
Yeah, me too. It's just decorative.
But speaking of digital scales, for really small quantities, like for spices and things like xanthan gum, you need to get what is casually known as a drug dealer scale, or more accurately known as a gram scale. I don't think you ever really need to get down to more than 0.1 accuracy.
Aha, the dealer scale that fits right in with Pulp Fiction. So, our movie opens with two robbers, Pumpkin and Honey Bunny. These more nicknames, we love that. They're having a deep conversation about the pros and cons of robbing different kinds of businesses. At first, you don't really understand that they're going to rob the place in a minute or two. I felt like I was caught off guard when I was watching that the first time.
Oh, for sure.
This diner was rumored to be based off of Denny's, but they wouldn't allow filming on location.
Boo, Denny's. Although, once you read the script, I wouldn't want my business in this movie either.
True.
What are your requirements for a good diner, Jen?
Ooh, yeah. The more retro, the better. If you see a variety of folks scattered around of different ages and occupations, it's an indicator of a great spot. Always look for regulars. I must have waffles, pie, and maybe a club sandwich, and I should be able to get a crisp side of bacon any time of the day. What about you, Clara?
Open 24 hours, comfortable booth seating, decent coffee, good pancakes or French toast, some ridiculous assortment of giant cakes and pies. In this scene, it looks like pretty standard diner breakfast fare. Coffee, eggs, bacon, and pancake.
It's weird because there's only one plate. It's one of them just not eating. Maybe they're sharing, but there are no share plates. What the hell? Anyway, I think diners make better breakfast than you would at home because of the gigantic hot griddle. It allows for hotter, more even heat. You'll get a better sear on your bacon or sausage, more even cooking on your pancakes or French toast. And many diners and breakfast places keep the home fries just chilling on the griddle on low on the far side throughout service. So they stay hot and super crispy on the bottom. And that's what's so special about diners, the short order. Everything, even on the biggest menu, can be made in a short amount of time. And this differs from fast food, where you're meant to hang out a little longer and sit at the diner.
I don't feel like I can ever match the quality and color of diner French toast in my own home, even as a professional chef. I think that's why I always order it when I'm out. I live for diner French toast and sausage with that cheap, gooey pancake syrup.
Really? No listeners are going to revolt when they hear this. I don't use syrup, period.
Oh my God.
Maybe I'll try to dip a little to try it, but I generally pick up my waffles and butter them like they're toast.
That is so weird.
I know, I'm a psychopath.
I don't know what to say to that.
I know, I'm sorry.
To each their own, everyone has different food preferences, but you are hearing this, listeners. I have never in my life heard of someone eating waffles like buttered toast.
I pick them up and eat with my hands too. Like, I don't use a fork and a knife.
Savage.
I know. It's because they're too sticky if they have syrup on them, and I don't like that.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I know.
I drown my waffles in syrup.
Wow.
I wouldn't say that I'm like a sweet tooth per se, but with certain things, you know what it is, I think about like French toast, pancakes, waffles, they're technically a sweeter breakfast brunch item, but I feel like there's a savory note to that, and like sweet and savory. But I do think that we can learn from the diner griddle and bring some of those techniques into the home kitchen.
Yeah, for people making home fries, hash browns, or other crispy potato preparations in a pan, let them cook for a while in a separate pan while you're preparing other things that'll lead to crispier, more golden brown potatoes.
Kind of mimicking the griddle effect.
But also you can simply buy a griddle or a flat top or a plancha for bulk breakfast preparation. It tends to have more even heating than just one pan on a stove.
It also depends on what kind of heating element you have. For me, I have an electric range and it definitely has uneven hot spots. I think gas is better for higher heat and more even heating.
Yeah, I much prefer cooking on gas, but alas, I also have electric.
City living, what are you gonna do? We return to the same diner from the opening scene at the end of the movie. Lovely bookend for sure. Vincent and Jules, our hitmen, are having breakfast, pancakes and bacon for Vincent, and what looks to be a blueberry muffin for Jules. Vincent offers Jules some of his bacon, which he refuses because he doesn't eat swine or unclean animals. Jen, how do you feel about alternatives to pork bacon, like turkey or beef?
Well, they don't get crispy like bacon does. They don't have any of that, internal fat. But I will cook it when a client has an allergy or something and I have to eat the rest of the stock. Did you also see that he's eating that muffin sideways like a psychopath?
I think that as chefs, we make a lot of judgments about people's sanity with how they eat, like eating buttered waffles. You're obviously a psychopath.
Okay, yeah, sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Agreed.
Let me cast the first waffle.
It's okay. So people might say, oh, I don't judge. Oh, you're a chef. You guys are snobs. My mom tried to put ketchup on a Philly soft pretzel.
Oh,
and
no.
I stopped her. I was like, you're Mother. Not allowed to do that. And she's like, but I like it. But we were in public too. And we were like, Red Eagles game. I go, no.
Oh my God, away. The worst place.
Put that away. Anyway, going back to the muffins. When I bake muffins, I tend to gravitate towards recipes where there is a lot of fat. They become less healthy and more cake-like than anything else.
Yeah, I get that. Do you have any other tips other than more fat?
Yes. When you have ingredients that you want evenly dispersed through the batter, you can toss them in a dry ingredient. For example, you can toss blueberries in a tiny bit of flour so they get more evenly distributed in the wet batter. You should also add citrus zest to sugar before adding it to your batter for a more evenly spread zest.
Ooh.
Do you have any muffin baking hacks?
Yes, I do. Well, going back to your blueberries, that creates resistance between the previously wet blueberry against the batter as it bakes. My tip is you don't have to buy muffin cups. You could just cut squares of parchment. Like, the muffin industrial complex is lying to you. Don't buy a separate thing. If you already have parchment paper, just cut squares. You're fine.
Actually, I think a lot of fancy bakeries, it looks more elegant to have this sort of...
Oh, yeah, the corners.
Yeah,
the
corners. Flaming cloche of parchment. And, you know, maybe they'll have like fleur-de-lis design on it or something.
Oh, yeah.
But I think it looks more upscale, more pro, more elegant. And you're right. It's a lot cheaper than getting aluminum or paper cupcake or muffin liners, as they're called.
There are pancakes in the movie. Clara, do you have any chefy tips for the ultimate pancake?
Buttermilk. Buttermilk really does make for better pancakes and waffles, in my opinion. I also like to add vanilla or almond extract for added flavor. And finally, make sure your leavener is active. Even baking powder has a shelf life. If it's too old, you won't get a decent rise out of any of your foods. Nobody wants a skinny record like pancake.
Yeah, it doesn't sound too delicious. Clara, have you ever tried waffling other foods? You know about this?
Yes, I do.
There was a Tumblr. Yes, there was a Tumblr called Will It Waffle? And defrosted hash browns and tots waffle very well in the waffle iron. It was actually one of the original COVID-era snacks we served at Wonderville.
That sounds amazing. My favorite Will It Waffle success story. There are these, I don't know what they're called in English. Do you know what I'm talking? It's like a compressed rice cake. It's sort of like a compressed, like, mochi. And it looks like a white plastic toy. It's like a brick.
Oh, yeah.
And then when you expose it to heat and oil, it poofs up almost like a balloon and marshmallow. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, the rice cakes that are dry, the dry blocks.
Oh, yeah. So dry black rice cake. There's a name for it in Japanese, which eludes me at the moment. And Kirimochi. I just know what they look like. They're about $1 a piece. They're pretty expensive. But those waffle unbelievably well.
Wow.
And then... I'll obviously do some syrup and some salt and pepper. It's so good. I think the waffle iron, because it's the heating element is on the top and the bottom, right? So you get more surface area that's getting crispy. And then you've got that ooey gooey, almost sort of rice cakey, marshmallowy inside.
Wow.
And then the sweet and then the salt and the pepper. So salt and pepper makes everything better. What is your go-to breakfast and lunch order at a diner?
This is such an intimate question, Clara.
Ooh.
It's like, how do you like your eggs in the morning? My answer is always unfertilized. just kidding. I'm actually not much of a diner breakfast person, but I'll go for waffles, like I mentioned before. Side of bacon, no syrup. The other things I might order, biscuits and sausage gravy, chicken fried steak for lunch, tuna melt, patty melt, key lime pie or chocolate chess pie. And sometimes diners will do this. I love a chocolate Coke.
Wait, tell me more. What is that?
It is simply Coke in a glass with ice and then chocolate syrup mixed in.
Okay, so you like that, but you won't put syrup on your waffle.
Hell no.
That's like all sugar.
I know.
it's like, I don't have enough sugar in the soda. Let me get some chocolate syrup.
Clara, I'm a complex human being.
Yes, you contain multitudes, much like a typical diner menu. For me, I already mentioned French toast and sausage, or pancakes and sausage, waffles and sausage. I'm a big sweet and savory, so I will drown the breakfast meats also in the syrup.
Wow.
But if it's lunchtime or dinner, I'll usually go for a BLT and fries.
Ooh, that sounds so good.
And I always tell people, it's really hard to mess up a BLT. I mean, decent bread, whatever mayonnaise. I like Duke's the best, or QP. But standard, you know, run-of-the-mill industrial mayonnaise is fine.
Yeah, can't really go wrong with it.
No, tomato lettuce. And then here's my chef hack. If you have a BLT, a sandwich, cheeseburger, whatever, hoagie hero sub grinder, whatever you call it, and it doesn't taste that great, salt and pepper the vegetables and you're seasoning the ingredients and it will taste better. If you get a BLT in the middle of winter, that tomato is gonna be pretty sad. Salt and pepper,
there you go.
I promise you, it will make your BLT better.
Sarah, again, with the chefy hacks. We love it.
That's why we're here. That's why we're here to share.
Okay, so we have multiple dining locations and landmark dishes throughout the movie. Let's just start at the beginning. We've got the diner at the opening, and again at 2 hours, 13 minutes. Moving on to 14 minutes, 58 seconds, we get a glimpse of Big Kahuna Burger. It's 7:30 a.m. Did they get this burger last night, or did they go out for it at 7 a.m.? I don't know.
Logically, I would say it had to have been the previous night, but it looks fresh when they're eating it.
The close-up of the burger is very good.
Right. And then also, it sounds like there's ice when Samuel L. Jackson, right, like a gangster, takes the drink and drinks out of it. Sort of vibes of There Will Be Blood.
I take my milkshake. Yes.
Yeah, that's such a power move.
I mean, I drink your milkshake. That's the line.
We will cover milkshakes and There Will Be Blood.
Oh, yes, totally. Later on, we get to Marcellus's club during the day. The bartender sells Butch, a.k.a. Bruce Willis, red apple cigarettes. Clara, do you know about red apple cigarettes?
I do not. Please tell me.
This is a running prop among all of Tarantino's films.
No way.
If you look closely, there will be either a logo or an apple with a worm in it or a pack of cigarettes that has a red apple on it.
Do you think that that's a nod to New York?
I'm not sure. Possibly. Or maybe it's biblical.
Forbidden fruit?
Yes, exactly.
You know, it's never called an apple in the Bible. It's always called forbidden fruit.
Ooh, interesting. Did not realize. This is also perhaps some foreshadowing when we find out that Vincent himself rolls his own cigarettes and later meets his demise. You know, like he's not participating in the universe of the movie.
Wow, that is a deep Easter egg. I'm impressed, Jen De La Vega.
I love to look up things. Later, we visit Jackrabbit Slim's, which is sort of like Planet Hollywood, or as Vincent says in the film, a wax museum with a pulse. Another notable timestamp in the film, at 1 hour 31 minutes, 18 seconds, Butch puts some cinnamon toaster pastries in the toaster at his apartment, and when they're done...
Blam, blam, blam!
Ah, Vincent's dead.
Even though this isn't a culinary movie in the way that Chef is a culinary movie, or, you know, there isn't as much food as Willy Wonka, there's actually a lot of culinary terms and techniques and ingredients. The opening scene, garçon, such an odd thing to do in a diner, but it's French for boy, but usually means a male waiter, a way to call for the waiter is to shout garçon, which is what he does. Again, it's this high-low mix that I think Tarantino is known for.
Which in either case is hella rude.
He doesn't care. He's about to rob the diner.
Yeah,
he
that's
he doesn't
true.
Give a, he doesn't give a poop. Denver omelet, my dad's favorite.
Really?
Yeah. He's always like, oh, why don't you make me Denver omelet, you know, with the ham and the pepper and the onions.
I've never been drawn to it. Never been drawn to it.
Oh my God, I think ham and eggs is insane. Like ham.
I do like ham and eggs, yeah. But the green peppers and onions, I don't know if I can get on board.
I think that they have to be cooked. Like, I don't think anyone wants to bite into raw onion and pepper. I think for me, I would saute them a little bit, get them a little translucent, a little soft, maybe a little caramelization on the edges.
Nice.
And then also for this, I like deli ham. Like I want the thin slices of ham so that they kind of float in the omelet. I don't want the chunks of ham. That's not kind of what I want.
Too thick.
Yeah, I don't like that. not for me. Going back to French terms, royal, French for royal, here used to describe something special, even though it's a fast food burger. Have you ever thought about like Burger King? It's like kings don't eat at Burger King.
Yeah.
But it's called Burger King and you get to wear a crown. And I mean,
that
I don't
was
care.
Fun. I remember that.
Yeah, exactly. I don't care how old you are. I would rock that crown today. It's fun to put on a crown and have your chicken finger and onion rings. That's my order at Burger King.
Oh,
when
nice.
I'm at the airport.
Well, I take umbrage with the line royale with cheese, because why would you say a French word and say the English word right after it? Why wouldn't it be royale fromage? Tarantino, I shake my fist.
I shake my fist at your inconsistent. Well, you know what I think it is? You mentioned it earlier. A quarter pounder with cheese is a more premium offering because it's more meat, but you can't call it that in a country that doesn't have the imperial.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
They had to make it special, so then it became the Royale. It's a special burger with cheese. You're right. It doesn't flow. But when people are looking at the menu really quickly, if it just says Royale, it's like, what the heck is that? You got to make things very simple for the audience. Going back to our favorite Planet Hollywood ripoff.
That's right.
Vincent orders a bloody as hell steak. Other ways to do this in a more elegant fashion: super rare, blue rare, black and blue, Pittsburgh rare, al sangue, to the blood in Italian.
Whoa, it's intense.
Yeah, it's intense. And then I think the funniest, because we are sort of a pop culture podcast as well, the funniest description of ordering the world's most rare or rarest steak is from Mashes of Sex.
Oh?
He says, "I want to have a steak so raw, it's like you took a live cow through a warm kitchen," or something like that. you took a cow through a warm room.
Wow.
Yeah. I was like, that is intense. And then again, we go back to Daniel Day-Lewis in Gangs in New York with that super thick steak that's still mooing. It is so rare.
So raw.
But it looks so good when he eats it, because it's just kissed with a little bit of heat, and then he's digging into it like the savage that he is.
Oh, definitely have to cover steak in another episode.
To quote Julia Child, I'm a card-carrying carnivore. I love meat, which is probably why my cholesterol is so high. Anyway, $5 shake, which would be about $10 today. What makes a milkshake that expensive?
Is it the milk? I don't know. Is it the ice cream? It might be the ice cream.
I think it's the quality of the ice cream. So if you go to the, like, what you can get at 7-Eleven or Wawa or your local C shop, convenience store, versus artisanal, handmade, local dairy, local mint. I just spent $10 on an affogato.
Whoa.
At Weckerly's. So it's chocolate hazelnut ice cream. One shot of espresso. It was delicious. I enjoyed it. I don't know that I would do that all the time.
I'm looking up the ice cream place I went to today. The milkshake is $8.
In New York? Wow, that's a deal.
In New York, yeah. It's Screen Door Brooklyn, which is my ice cream shop.
$8 is what a milkshake costs in trendy Brooklyn today. Mm-hmm. This is a $10 shake. This is very expensive.
Yeah.
Because it's not even in New York. It's in LA.
$5 shake.
But today it would be $10.
True. Yeah, today it would be $10.
So this is a very, very expensive milkshake.
Those crazy ones that you see on TikTok that you have to eat through the toppings before you get to the shake, those are about $25, $30.
So let me ask you about that. What is your opinion of food marketing just for Instagram?
I do not interact with it. I think it's taking away the original essence of enjoying that dish. Like, if I can't stick a straw in it and enjoy it as a shake, like, it's not a shake anymore. If the sandwich is bigger than my forearm or taller than my forearm and I can't eat it in one bite, that is no longer a sandwich to me.
Yeah, I feel like we're back in the Roman times. This conspicuous consumption. Look how much excess we have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the unicorn milkshake with the cake and the donut and the glitter and the sprinkles and the edible straw and, you know, again, $25. It's 2,500 mm-hmm. calories. For me, it's gross. A, I don't want to eat it. B, I think it's abusing food. And
yeah.
I think if you're, maybe I'm a purist, but the purpose of making food is to feed people.
Yes.
So that they can eat and nourish their bodies. And I think when you're putting in something that is higher than the amount of calories you're supposed to have in a day for one thing that no one could possibly eat, that you're literally just doing for the gram.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's conspicuous consumption at a level that I find pretty disturbing.
Yeah. A friend of mine, Emily Corvey, had philosophized about this. We had a discussion about junk food, and there's a point where it reaches performance and it's devoid of love. It's devoid of care. That hospitality that is associated with food and feeding people, it's just for the show now.
You're taking away the most important element of food, which is nourishing people, showing love.
It's
also just very empty.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, oh, look at this thing that I made. It's so good.
I'm not going to eat it. I'm actually going to throw away half of it.
Cooking, I think, is a sacred act of feeding yourself and feeding people that you love.
Yes.
And when it's turning into this empty, performative, clickbaity situation, you're losing the heart, you're losing the essence, and it just bums me out. And I think that that's one of the reasons why people are so disconnected from food.
On a lighter note, I kind of wanted to talk about the diner table, like things that you're going to see at most diners, like the married ketchup, sugar in a dispenser, packets of sugar alternative, room temp creamer in the silver little pourer thing.
Absolutely.
Salt, pepper, and my favorite, the mini jukebox.
For sure.
Do you know that means, the married ketchup? Well, at the end of a shift, for anyone who's ever worked at a diner or at a restaurant, yeah. your boss might say, "Can you go marry the ketchup?"
Yeah.
And I definitely stared at somebody the first time I heard that. I was like, what does that mean? It means we are pouring dregs of ketchup into the next bottle so it looks full. So you marry all the bottles that are on the floor currently and then fill the empty ones with the bulk container.
I know,
so like, it's just show.
I know, but you know, when you think about that, you're right. They always do it. Marry the condiments and
marry the ketchup.
I don't know. That's got to be in some way sort of unsanitary, right?
I guess if people have touched the spout.
Public, people are dirty. Anyone who's ever worked a sample counter, which I have,
mm-hmm.
people are gross. Blow their nose, touch their hair, clean their ear, wipe their mm-hmm. mouth, and they will stick their hand into the sample jar.
In the diner, it's kind of like so many people are passing through. People are driving trucks. People are like,
yeah.
Diners are scattered. Like, they're not always in the city centers, you know? They're
That's
actually
true.
Better when they're roadside.
Look at where you see a lot of giant Mack trucks, yeah. tractor trailers, semis, 18-wheelers, because these are people that drive all over the country all the time. Their one bright spot in their day is getting food. Where are the truckers stopping?
Going to eat, yeah.
That is where you want to go. My family used to do a lot of road trips, and I remember just like you'd see all these like giant trucks lined up. And I didn't know it at the time, but that was a good place.
You know, I totally forgot about this. I had to look it up again. But do you remember what the Pepsi challenge was?
Wasn't it the blind taste test where
yes.
you tried two drinks without knowing which one was Coke or Pepsi? And you had to pick the better one.
Right.
And apparently they ran with this advertising campaigns because it was called the Pepsi Challenge. I think Pepsi fared better
obviously.
Than Coca-Cola. Are you a Pepsi person, not Coca-Cola?
No. I don't like Pepsi, but it fared better in the commercials because it's commercials.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
But let me ask you, in a blind taste test today, Coke
oh, yeah.
or Pepsi?
Coke, because they changed the Pepsi recipe.
Okay. I also like Coke better.
Mm-hmm.
My educated guest chef opinion. Pepsi tastes sweeter to me.
I can taste the chemicals more in the Pepsi.
Interesting. Okay, so you
taste
more
chemicals.
That's
why I don't like it.
I taste more sugar. And then I also feel like Coke is more fizzy than Pepsi.
Yeah, I've had that experience.
Yeah, so I don't know if it's because it, like whenever I've had Pepsi, it's like fountain soda. But I just feel like the Coke is less sugary and more carbonated.
Mm.
And then I'm going to test your hypothesis of there's more chemical taste to Pepsi.
I haven't tried it in a while.
Asterisk, yes. Jen and I are both healthy adults. We do not drink. I don't really drink soda.
Yeah,
honestly,
me either.
I can't tell you the last time I went to the grocery store and bought soda.
I'm a seltzer lady.
Me too.
Just seltzer.
My favorite is club soda and bitters.
Ooh, yeah.
I drink that.
If my tum is feeling a little unsettled, I'll have that.
If I go to a bar and I don't want to have a drink, I get a club soda and bitters, and then I feel like I'm drinking. It looks like I'm drinking. It doesn't have to be like, oh, why aren't you drinking? It's like, aren't you sober? And then it just shuts down a lot of line of questioning, which I don't need.
Mm-hmm,
I feel like
mm-hmm.
I fit in.
So, Clara, where is the best diner?
This is technically outside of Philly, but I love Jaime's Deli in Marion. It has a diner feel with booths, excellent breakfast, sandwiches, delicious soups, and Mile High cakes and pies.
Ooh-hoo.
What about you, Jen?
Well, we have Three Decker Diner in Greenpoint. I have to say, pour one out, rest in peace, to Odessa, which was in Manhattan. That was a go-to. There's Red Line Diner up in Fishkill, upstate New York. We have New Munson Diner up in Liberty. I was also a huge fan of the YouTube series Breakfast at Sulamae's. Do you know about this, Clara?
I know, like Sulamae's Diner in Fishtown, which is fantastic. But I did not know about this YouTube series. Will you tell me more?
Yeah, so it started about 15, 16 years ago, and there are a lot of older regulars there at the diner, and someone started to make videos with those older folks, and they eventually started to interview bands who were coming to play in Philly. There are some excellent intergenerational interviews on that YouTube channel.
That sounds amazing. I'm going to go look it up right now.
Okay, listeners, can you share your favorite diner in your town? We want to know. You want to know the most unbelievable bit about Pulp Fiction?
No, what is it?
It's that Wolf said that Toluca Lake is 40 minutes away and he'll get there in 10. That's movie magic.
Tune in next time as we explore the ultimate bowl of ramen in the movie Tampopo.
Thank you for tuning in to The Cinema Chefs. Please share your tips and tricks with our Instagram at The Cinema Chefs or drop us a line at thecinemachefs@gmail.com. We hope you enjoyed the show. This is Jen.
And Clara, signing off.
Just remember, you can become a better cook just by watching a movie. The Cinema Chefs was recorded in Brooklyn, New York and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Edited by Jen De La Vega. Music by Penguin Music, Paradise Island from Pixabay. And our logo was by Nikki Newsom.